This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
People have to stop thinking in terms of how many children they want and thinking in terms of what kind of a world are their children going to live in? What are you going to pass on to them?
It took humankind 1,800 years to get from a global population of about 200 million to 1 billion. But it only took us 200 years to go from a billion to 7 billion. Most students of population agree that the planet cannot support current rates of population growth for much longer. This week, Sea Change Radio begins a two-week series on population. Today, we spend the whole show talking with Paul Ehrlich, author of the environmental classic, The Population Bomb, and one of the foremost scholars on the subject. Dr. Ehrlich talks about the optimism of that book, the events and policies that subdued that optimism, and the ideas that drive his most recent tome, Humanity on a Tightrope. We ask him about what needs to happen now to ensure the sustainability of the planet and the human race, and about why controlling population growth is a centerpiece of the solution he envisions. He also shares his views on economics, immigration, U.S. politics, and his personal choice to have only one child. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He is a professor at Stanford in Population Studies and Biology. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here.
So you've been studying population in its different forms for over 40 years now. Let's take it 40 years from now. Where do you see things being 40 years from now, population-wise?
One can't predict 40 years in the future, but one can take a shot at it. We're at 7 billion now. That's three and a half times the population when I was born, because there were 2 billion people when I was born. And we're scheduled, in quotes, to add maybe another 2 billion by the middle of the century, and then go on from 9 to 10 to 11 and so on. The U.S. is at the moment scheduled to grow to infinity. Don't hold your breath. The next 2 billion people we add to the planet will do disproportionately large amounts of damage to our life support systems because human beings are smart. We didn't start farming the marginal land and now working gradually towards the river bottoms. We did it in reverse. So every new person we add has to be supported with food from more marginal land, with water from more distant and deeper sources. With oil, if you're stupid enough to keep supplying people with oil from deeper wells. You know, the first well in Pennsylvania went down 70 feet from the surface and had a gusher. The more recent well you may have had called to your attention started a mile underwater, went down a couple more miles. Everything costs us disproportionately. It's called diminishing marginal returns. What I think all of my colleagues agree is that if we don't change our ways dramatically, there's going to be a collapse of society. We don't know exactly when. There are all kinds of signs of it right now. One cannot be as optimistic as I was back in 1968. 1968 was sort of a golden time when we saw problems coming, but we thought they were fixable, and we thought we would do something about them. But actually, thanks in large degree to Ronald Reagan, the United States has done nothing at all to solve any of its major problems. And so things are not great here in the empire.
Can you expand on Reagan's policies, in particular on which ones you feel were most detrimental to getting us to where we are population-wise today?
On environmental issues, we started passing good laws, not on population, but on dealing with the environment under Richard Nixon. And Ronald Reagan came in, and the first thing he did was shred the Global 2000 report, which was an interdepartmental report of the government of what we had to do if we were going to not have the country deteriorate rapidly over the next period of years. He took the solar collectors off of the White House and introduced a series of morons in appropriate departments of the government, and actually reversed virtually everything sensible that had been going on in the United States, and we're paying the price today. I mean, the continuation of Ronald Reagan today is grabbing more money from the poor and giving it to the rich. It was hysterical that Obama was accused of being a redistributionist during the presidential campaign. But, of course, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush were champion redistributionists. They took more money from the poor and gave it to the rich than anyone else has in our presidential history. It's quite interesting to see the way they protect their super rich owners and buddies.
So in 1968, when you wrote The Population Bomb, there was a lot more optimism in some respects as a carryover from the progress that was made from World War II.
Well, we were optimistic that we could do things. We had a can-do spirit. And the whole idea with The Population Bomb was people are trying to do something about the environment now, but they're ignoring one of the major drivers. You know, if you have everybody's impact on their life support systems and double the number of people, you haven't moved at all. You're right where you were before.
But let's look at like the 40 years before 1968. Think of that tremendous progress, obviously, that was made in terms of women's rights and racial progress and where we were technologically.
When I was a kid, there were hangings going on, lynchings going on in the South. If you were a woman, you could be a nurse, you could be a grammar school teacher, you could be a secretary. Well, that's pretty much it. Although I'm a pilot now, and I show you the progress, I took a lot of my instrument training from a female pilot, and now you have women flying jets with hundreds and hundreds of people in them. So we made a lot of progress in human relations, nowhere's near enough, either in the gender or the race area, but a lot of progress nonetheless. We also were, trying to rebuild the world after the Second World War and did a pretty good job of that in many places and a lousy job in other places. But of course, when The Population Bomb was written, it looked like we had the capability of changing our ways. And The Population Bomb was an extraordinarily optimistic book because, of course, we didn't know anything at that time about the ruining of the ozone layer. We didn't know at that time that we were destroying the biodiversity of the planet. We knew about climate change, and we thought that warming or cooling was possible from human impacts on the environment, on the atmosphere. But the work hadn't been done by Ralph Cicerone and others to show that CO2 was only half of the forcing and making it crystal clear that things were going to happen faster and the direction we were going to go is warming, which has happened. So basically, the book didn't know about many of the huge problems. One of the big problems it was concerned with, which was a growing hunger, was partially solved by a thing called the Green Revolution. But, we had 3.5 billion people in those days, and there were about 500 million hungry. And now we have 7 billion people, and there are about 1 billion hungry. And it always amuses me that morons on the blog say, Ehrlich was wrong. He said the battle to feed all of humanity is over. Well, we got 1 billion hungry people today. We've never managed to feed everybody. When people say, oh, don't worry, technology will allow us to take care of everybody, give them health. We can even support, those days they used to say, we could even support 5 billion people, giving them good health, good education, good diets, and so on. And I always used to say, and Anne would say too, okay, why don't you take care of the ones we have today, show us you can do it, and then we can talk about whether population growth is a sensible idea. And of course, in all those years, they've never managed to come close to taking care of everybody. Today, I think it's close to 3 billion people are living on $2 a day or less, 1 billion of them really hungry. I mean, we do a wonderful job, and yet there's still idiots saying, oh, no problem, we can support 16 billion people or 20 billion people. There's not a prayer. There's no scientist who's ever can do arithmetic that thinks that's possible.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Paul Ehrlich. He's the author of the new book, Humanity on a Tightrope, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. What kind of moment do you think we need, besides something as cataclysmic as another World War II, that would ignite that same kind of feeling on a global level?
Well, this is a huge problem. How do we get the kind of change that we desperately need? And that's what virtually all of my attention is focused on, and most of my colleagues. We've organized a thing called the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, which is starting to try and bring together scholars in the social sciences, the humanities, and the sciences with the public and decision makers to talk about and think about the things we've got to do globally if we're going to have a chance of persisting as any kind of sustainable society. And this is a huge problem. You can see an example of it almost every night on TV, or at least you could in recent months, and that is people complaining about the high cost of gasoline. Even the stupidest economists, the ones who write, say, for the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, know that gasoline isn't overpriced, it's underpriced. In other words, gasoline, we should be paying at least $10 a gallon and increasing it 25 cents a gallon every couple of months, changing our tax laws so that doesn't clobber the poor. In other words, taking the revenue and doing things like paying down the FICA tax, which is a regressive tax and so on. But if you put into the cost of gasoline all of the so-called externalities, what economists call externalities, the things that are not captured in the market price, like almost half of our military expenditure is designed entirely to keep the flow of oil coming towards the United States, to invade other countries and get their oil or control their oil. The costs for future generations of air pollution, of rapid climate change, which is likely to starve many, many people to death and so on, are not included in the costs of gas. And smart economists will tell you if you want to fix the environment, one of the first things you have to do is try and get the prices right. Can't do it for everything, but you can do it for a lot of things. And gasoline is a prime example of a place where we not only don't get the prices right, we get them stupidly wrong, and we shovel huge amounts of money, again, to the rich who are getting ever richer. By the way, that's a characteristic of empires as they start to fade, is that the elite grab more and more of what's left. And this is, there are books on this, as well known what happens, started in Rome and so on, but we're seeing the sort of gated rich getting more and more money while shoveling more and more crap at the population as a whole and telling them they won't be happy until they consume more, even though every survey shows that there's been no increase in general happiness in the United States or Japan as our GDP has increased and increased. In fact, it looks like in the United States that happiness is going down now.
So you have children, right?
I have a child.
You have one child. What can I ask, what went into the thought process of having one child?
One does have to set an example. I think the slogan ought to be stop at two. Anne and I decided that we'd rather put our effort into raising one child. She's absolutely wonderful, has a PhD in economics. And after teaching in universities and doing that for a while, she stopped it all and became a dog trainer. And she loves it. And she says that that training dogs is a lot like teaching undergraduates microeconomics.
So it was a conscious...
Certainly a conscious decision. Absolutely. People have to stop thinking in terms of how many children they want and thinking in terms of what kind of a world are their children going to live in? What are you going to pass on to them? And you may want 20 children, but that is unethical and immoral, not only towards your own children, of course, but towards everybody else's children. In other words, you're taking more of the world's resources. The very best thing one can do in the United States to save the environment is limit themselves to one or at most two children.
We had Václav Smil on the program recently, and he was saying how Americans have become ungovernmental. And as I hear you talk about, officials can't get elected if they raise gas prices, and we have a system which seems to be counterintuitive to trying to further our cause as organisms on this planet. Can you envision either cataclysmic events or events that make us all come together to actually start trying to actuate the change that we need?
Well, the U.S. government is broken. I mean, we have elected a mob of morons to the Senate. I doubt if there's more than one or two people in the Senate who could tell you how we know that the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere comes very largely from human use of fossil fuels. In other words, there's no question about that science, but a few well-paid people and organizations, the American BS Institute in Washington, the Heritage Foundation, so on and so forth, have just hired people to lie to the American people, and our training in science in our schools, which are underfunded and particularly short on science education, don't allow people to see through the BS that's being generated. So we have what we need to do, and it was tried actually about 20 years ago, is try and rewrite the Constitution as an instrument for the 21st century instead of as an instrument as it originally was, of course, for the 18th century. The whole idea originally was you sent smart people to Washington, and if you liked what happened, you sent them back. But it was a representative government and not an outright democracy. You didn't want the totally uneducated general population making the rules. You wanted to send the best of the people you knew to Washington.
You don't want just somebody who you want to have a beer with.
I don't mind having a beer with smart people, but unfortunately, there are very few of them in the Congress. So the nowadays, of course, the people who are supposedly just being our representatives are actually tracking what we think all the time. In other words, polls, there's instantaneous communication, which means we're retreating towards a general democracy, which doesn't seem to function very well. You have a confederacy of dunces, you get the results that you expect. I thought Obama is a huge improvement over George W. Bush. I would say that he is at least 1,000 times better or smarter. But we needed someone who was 1,000,000 times better or smarter, as somebody who didn't hook up with the fat cats on. Look at the influence that the economic financial community has on our society. These people are total parasites. Nobody on Wall Street does anything of any use to society as a whole. A lot for the rich, but if they actually function as economists sometimes think they should function, they would be more efficient at promoting growth in the United States. That's the only impact they would have. And anybody who can do the numbers knows we can't stand any more growth in the United States. There was an idiotic column in the New York Times when the country went through 300 million, I think. It was looking forward when it was finally announced that in the next 40 years, we're going to add roughly 100 million people to the United States. David Brooks said that'll reinvigorate the country, by God. That is, reinvigorate the crumbling infrastructure of the country, add even more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere so that we can end up starving ourselves to death or washing away our communities along seashores or flooding out the people in the southern part of the Mississippi River. In other words, the U.S. is the most overpopulated nation in the world. And to have some idiot writing in the New York Times that even increasing our overpopulation by another 100 million, that'll take us to 400 million people, when no one has ever come up with even a semi-sane reason for having more than 130 million Americans alive at one time. So we're approaching triple the sensible population size.
Oh! Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Paul Ehrlich. He's the author of the new book, Humanity on a Tightrope, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. Paul, there's been some writing and discussion in the last few years about coming population collapse. What are your feelings about that concept, especially in light of you being the inventor of the term population bomb?
Well, we certainly don't want a population collapse in the sense of huge numbers of people dying off, which is what we're programmed to do right now. What we want to do is gradually lower the size of the human population to a sustainable level, which at current guesswork and with a lot of assumptions in it would be 1.5 or 2 billion people, and keep them going essentially forever. In other words, right now, the United States is bound for a total collapse sometime probably in the next 30 or 40 years because it's going to keep adding more and more people till it just crumbles. On the other hand, if you want, like I do, to have the maximum number of Americans live, then you have a sustainable population in the United States and keep it going for millions of years. Better to have 100 million people in the United States and have the United States last a million years than it would be to have 400 million people in the United States and have the United States last another 50 years. And of course, we know how to do this. In other words, the cheery news is the scholarly community knows what needs to be done. The issue right now and the direction that all the solutions lie in is changing the economic and political system until it can learn to deal with global problems and regional problems. And that means revisiting things like the Federalist, anti-Federalist arguments in the Assembly of the United States, because there many of the issues are very parallel to what we need to do to get some kind of global governance from disparate nations. And we know how to do a lot of this stuff. The problem is, how do you get it done against the forces that are just saying, okay, as long as we get richer during our lives, it doesn't make any difference what happens to our children, grandchildren, or other descendants.
But one of the things that makes people optimistic is, look at some of these countries, Catholic countries, where the education of women is increasing, and you see the family sizes diminishing.
Oh, we've got some good news on the population front. That is, some of the countries that most need to shrink are starting to. That is, the rich European countries. The problem is, we're already way beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. So shrinkage is going to have to be relatively fast, and that's very difficult to do humanely. In other words, it means really working hard on getting the birth rates down. But on the area of consumption, you got to remember that the number of people multiplies with how much each one consumes and what kind of technologies they use to service that consumption. And every politician and virtually every economist thinks more consumption is good. And again, if you double the number of people while you're halving each one's consumption, you're standing still as far as trying to maintain yourself on a planet where the life support systems are deteriorating fast. And so the issue is, can we organize ourselves? And I hope we can. That's what the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior is all about, to spread our empathy much more so we stop taking away from the poor and giving to the rich. That's essential if we're going to get the kind of cooperation we need to solve our problems. And if we get everybody behind a trend to try and get birth rates in every country down in the vicinity of 1.5 children per couple. And there, some of the good news is that despite the Catholic hierarchy's very unethical and immoral position on this, Catholics aren't paying any attention to them. The population explosion is not a Catholic problem. Catholic countries in Europe have some of the lowest birth rates. The trouble is that the Catholic hierarchy can't admit that the Protestants were right and get rid of their silly ideas on reproduction. The big problem from the Catholics is the Vatican terrorizing politicians in places like the United States. If they would knock that off, then they could be on the right side instead of being one of the major forces of destruction for humanity. So the Catholic hierarchy, very bad. Catholics as a whole, very good. In the United States, Catholics use abortion and birth control more than Protestants. So,
Well, birth control and those issues aside, one of the things about organizing population flow is immigration, which is an issue that's a difficult political one to discuss.
Immigration is the most difficult ethical and political issue. And in part, it has to do with countries like the United States have the world's wealth flowing towards them. And it's hardly a terrible thing to think that people want to flow along with the wealth. And it's part, again, of the maldistribution of resources on the planet, the fact that we do desperately need redistribution. We don't need the United States growing. We need the United States shrinking. We need to be using less stuff to make less crap. The automobile is over, for example. People don't seem to understand that even if you make it super efficient, the scheduled increase in number of automobiles on the planet will be the end of humanity. In other words, the fact that you're driving around with a couple tons of steel wrapped around you, throwing bits of tire into the air continually, trying to maintain huge areas of the planet paved so these automobiles can get around. In other words, we've designed the planet around automobiles. The last calculation I saw is that the average speed of transport calculated properly in an automobile is something like 8 or 9 miles an hour, because you have to calculate in it all the time you spend working and all the money you have to make to support the Navy that gets that helps get the oil coming to us, to pave the roads, to buy the oil, to buy the car. And when you look at all that effort, it hasn't really increased our speed of transport significantly at all, particularly because it's helped greatly to destroy our life support systems and ruin our health. So, you know, you put it all together, we need big change. And that's the cheery message. We have changed as a species over time very dramatically. We gave up hunting and gathering, and we took up agriculture, and very gradually we have been changing our ethical positions. Slavery has been reduced around the world. Racial prejudice has been reduced, at least in the United States and many other countries. We have more gender equity and so on. The problem is the change is too damn slow. And what we need to do is do the things we know how to do, but much faster. And a really good start would be throwing most of our politicians out of office and getting a new bunch.
Paul Ehrlich, the author of over 40 books, and his most recent one is Humanity on a Tightrope. Paul, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Funkadelic, Sly and the Family Stone, and the B-52s. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.